First Coast Connect with Melissa Ross is sponsored in part by Baptist Health.
Florida reaches a grim milestone in deaths from COVID-19. Friends, family, and colleagues remember the late Tommy Hazzouri. And could our schools finally be rid of standardized testing? Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the top stories of the week with our Friday roundtable. You can listen or you can check them out and watch the live stream right now on Facebook, YouTube, and on demand at PBS Jax Passport. Then later in the hour, it's the debut of our brand new medical show, What's Health Got to Do with It? That's coming up later, but first it's Friday, and here to discuss a busy week in the news, there is no other kind in Florida. We welcome back David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union. Hey, David.
Good morning, Melissa.
Good to see you. Ann Schindler of First Coast News back with us. Hi, Ann.
Hey, Melissa. Good morning.
Good morning. New to the panel, Joe McClain of WJXT Channel 4, the local station. Hey, Joe.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And in a few moments, we'll be joined by Letitia Barriola of Action News Jax. Lots to talk about this week. We'll go to your calls in a moment, 549-2937 to join us. And again, you can watch us online, Facebook and YouTube right now. We're going to begin with our top story. Florida's pandemic death toll surpassed 50,000 people Thursday. A grim milestone reached after a summer surge of new cases, hospitalizations, and deaths fueled by the highly contagious Delta variant of the virus. This week, the state reached the second highest point of cases and hospitalizations since the pandemic began in spring of last year. The state reported 1,554 new deaths to the CDC Thursday and nearly 10,000 new cases. Since the pandemic began, Florida has now recorded 50,811 deaths. But the total number of deaths is very likely an undercount, actually, due to delays and changes in reporting by the Florida Department of Health. We begin the hour with a closer look at this. 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax. David Bauerlein, let's begin with you. Our ICUs around town are basically full, just about at capacity. A trending topic on Twitter this morning is Florida is Vietnam, meaning that we now have more deaths from COVID in this state alone than all of the soldiers who died during the Vietnam War. It's simply critical that people understand how deadly this variant still is and that they get vaccinated and continue to mask up. David.
Yeah, and all the data shows that being vaccinated greatly, greatly reduces the risk of a life-threatening illness and, in the worst case, dying from a COVID-19 infection. Certainly, Jacksonville has been its own hotspot for the infection. And while it is good that cases are going down and the spread is going down, as you mentioned, ICU beds are still about where they were. And that's bad news because what we've seen when we have these waves is that the last part of it is it takes a while for people to get infected. It takes a while for the infection to turn into an illness. And then, unfortunately, we're going to have more deaths still coming out of this latest wave.
That's right. It's 549-2937. Ann Schindler, First Coast News. Infectious disease researchers who've looked at the Delta wave in other countries say we should anticipate another resurgence of COVID this winter. It pains me to say it, but we are in it for such a long haul here.
Yeah, and, you know, the Delta variant has really, I think, proven to be so particularly contagious and virulent. You know, it is it's almost like a different pandemic than we had than a year ago. But, you know, there are also some hints of good news. I saw that there was a story in Forbes that crunched some data from the New York Times, you know, which really has great data resources in terms of COVID on a local and a national level. And it says that Florida has seen like a 47% drop in COVID cases in the past couple of weeks, which is the largest in the United States. And so that's promising. Our vaccines are up a little bit. But, you know, our governor still has some mixed messaging on vaccines. I mean, there was a press conference in Gainesville this week where he invited up city employees who are suing the city for mandatory vaccination policies. And one of them said that, falsely said that, you know, the COVID vaccine scrambles your DNA somehow. And the governor not only didn't, you know, refute it or contradict it at the press conference, but he also, when asked about it later, just said he didn't hear the comment.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in terms of being really, you know, strong and forthright on vaccines, it's been a little squishy.
Yeah. Joe McLean, Channel 4, what about that? The governor certainly knows that what that individual said at that news conference, standing behind the state of Florida seal, by the way, that's inaccurate. He continues to flirt with anti-vaxxers in his goal to presumably become a Republican nominee for president in 2024. At the same time, the governor is in another clash with the Biden White House. President Joe Biden and his administration are saying they're going to start controlling how much Regeneron monoclonal antibody treatments go to different states around the country that are hotbeds for the virus. Governor DeSantis has been a big proponent of Regeneron and has downplayed the importance of vaccination in recent months. That could affect the numbers here as well. Joe.
I think what we're seeing is, obviously, there's no secret that the pandemic has been used as political fodder, as something to rally people. The arguments for, you know, personal freedom with regards to getting the vaccine, when you know, basically every doctor said this is what is going to help keep people out of the hospital. I think what the governor is trying to do is, obviously, the governor isn't denying that the pandemic is a thing, that it is a crisis. But I think what I'm seeing is him trying to carve out his own thing to stand behind, and that's Regeneron rather than vaccines, because now, obviously, as we know, vaccines has become such a thing that so many people think that taking the vaccine is now also taking a political stance, which is just hugely damaging.
Yeah. Letitia Barriola, Action News Jax, with us now. She just got off the air. So, Letitia, thanks for turning around quickly. You know, two things can be true at the same time. Regeneron is helpful in treating people with early stage COVID before they become really sick. It is part of a multi-pronged strategy to beat this virus. Now, that said, Letitia, it's not as smart or as proactive as getting vaccinated so that you don't get sick or seriously sick in the first place.
Yeah, you know, the governor is, you know, sort of proud of the fact that Florida was into this antibody treatment, you know, months ago or well before most of the country. And so that's a talking point for him, right? That we've had it, Jacksonville, the first city to, you know, open up over at the library. And you know, so that's one of his talking points, that we've been on this, I believe in this, and we're going to stay on it. But I think it's important to note that, you know, it's almost like treating the symptoms and not the problem. Because at the end of the day, when those people who are really sick, I mean, we saw the pictures. It was beyond disturbing to see people on the ground, sick as ever, looking to get some relief. But you can't help but think about all the other people that maybe possibly those people have been around, and how, you know, if how contagious that was within their household. And you think about all the lives connected to the sick people going to get treatment. And you just think, are we truly getting to the root of the problem, which is how contagious this variant is? And yes, we want to help people who are sick. We want to help them feel better. But in order for us to go back to some kind of normalcy, I think we can all agree we've got to get this under control. And it's been proven over and over again that the vaccine is the best way to do it.
We'll go to your calls in a moment. Join our roundtable now, 549-2937. You can watch this panel, too, on our live video stream on Facebook and YouTube. David Bauerlein, Florida Times Union. You know, we learned this week that 1 in 500 Americans in the United States, 1 in 500 people now has died of COVID-19. I don't think there's anybody now that doesn't know someone who's been impacted by this virus. Either they directly know someone who's gotten sick, they directly know someone who has died, or they have an indirect connection to a death from COVID-19. David, death is getting closer and closer to all of us in this pandemic.
It is, without a doubt. And I think that I think you're right. We all know somebody who has either died from COVID or has had a near brush with death with COVID. The figures are that in Duval County, one out of every eight deaths since the pandemic started have had COVID involved with them. So this is something that, you know, it's been unfolding over such a long period of time that, you know, when you get to this milestone of 50,000 deaths, you do have to stop and think that this has been a truly horrific pandemic. And yes, the personal toll, the emotional toll has been great on a lot of families, a lot of people who lost loved ones, close friends. It's been devastating from that standpoint.
Here's a tweet from a listener. Let's go to Ann Schindler. Vaccine only will get us to where other countries like Singapore are now. We need more non-pharmaceutical interventions like masks, remote schooling, better ventilation. Ann Schindler, what about that? And Ann, let me get your thoughts on the governor saying that he will fine cities and municipalities around the state that try to institute vaccine passports or vaccine requirements.
As we were saying earlier, I mean, this has become such a political matter that it almost any decision that comes down really doesn't seem to be based too much in health or science. Punishing municipalities for trying to police their own, you know, area or monitor the health of their own citizens is just sort of counterintuitive in any pandemic setting. But it's interesting, you know, given all of the coverage recently of this Theranos case, I heard a soundbite from President Obama recently when we were going through this Ebola scare a few years ago, and there were really, you know, major fears that there could be a much more fatal virus, you know, taking place here in the United States with like a 50% fatality rate. And he's talking at that time in the soundbite about we could be facing hundreds of thousands of deaths.
Yeah.
Is what he's like emphasizing, like it's unbelievable, but we could actually be facing that. And it's like, we've so outpaced that. It almost feels like we've lost our mooring in terms of like what is acceptable. 50,000 deaths is an extraordinary number of deaths.
In one state. That's right. Lots of calls. Join our roundtable now. Lots of news to go through this hour, but we begin with the grim milestone Florida has reached in COVID deaths this week. 50,000 dead. 549-2937. Bill in Mandarin. Hello, Bill.
Good morning. 3 points. First of all, it would be extremely helpful if you guys did the mathematics for your listeners. That 1 in 500 equates to about 600,000 deaths. I don't know of any war we fought in where the first 18 months the fatality rate was that high. Second, you would also be quite helpful if you would begin to do some analysis on the extra cost of this pandemic, say comparing Florida, a very non-compliant state, with others, because once you start talking about the bucks, people get more tuned in. And there's a closing point. I hope old DeSantis does run for president. The nation could use a good 5-minute laugh. Thank you.
Okay, without getting into the last comment, Joe McClain, yes, 600,000 dead around the country. Florida has taken a much more laissez-faire approach to the pandemic, Joe arguing that it's better for business. That said, there is a real economic cost that can be measured to our healthcare system and to our economy overall as the death toll continues to mount. Joe. All right, I think we might have lost Joe for a moment. Let's go to Leticia Barriola. Leticia.
Yeah, I think that he's right that it is helpful to talk about the everyday impact that this pandemic is having on our small businesses, is having on our hospital costs, and what people are shelling out to take care of themselves, the days that they're missing from work when they're out from 2 weeks. what happens when your kids are home with you for 2 weeks when they've been exposed. You can almost always trace this back to either money loss, I mean, but heck, your sanity lost as well. I mean, the mental toll that this has had on people the last year and a half or so has been, I don't even know if we can measure that right now. We're still in the thick of it. And so, I like talking about the everyday impacts because as newsies, right, we get into the numbers, we get into the cost and the political drama, but a lot of people I talk to every day just out and about, they're thinking about what's right in front of them and how this impacts them. And it's easier for them to see like, okay, yeah, our ICUs are full, but we don't have cameras in the eyes. They don't see these people. They don't know them in particular in some cases. So I think it's wise of us to talk more about the financial costs, the stress, the fear, and just the normalcy that we've all lost since the pandemic has begun.
Susie in Mandarin. Hi, Susie. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Hey, Melissa. You know, I think you've heard my story last week. My 94-year-old father-in-law is at a nursing home here in Jacksonville. He was fully vaccinated in Seminole County before we moved him up here in March. And on the 7th of September, after we found out that the nursing home was closing down due to COVID, we found out he had tested positive. Now, we have been trying to get the monoclonal antibodies for him.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what I'm running into is no one seems to know how to get it in a nursing home. We can't put him in a car and take him to the library. He's in a skilled nursing facility. So yesterday I did some nosing around on the internet and found out that on Governor DeSantis's homepage, he has this brag book, if you will, where everyone's thanking him for the monoclonal antibodies. And apparently in Sarasota, someone contacted his office, Alexandra, in Sarasota and about her grandfather in a nursing home, and he sent out a strike force from his office. I am trying to figure out how we get this strike force to the nursing home where my father-in-law is. I'm finding this whole situation to be ridiculous. The doctor doesn't know how to order it. The nurses tell us the pharmacy that services the nursing home can't get them. But DeSantis is standing on a stage saying, oh, look what we've done with monoclonal antibodies, where our most vulnerable, our nursing home patients, have been totally left in the dark and left out of this. They were the ones that started this last March when we started having deaths in nursing homes. So it seems to me that DeSantis should have developed some sort of protocol to help them while he was opening up sites in libraries.
Susie, thanks for that. Joe McLean, that presents a really interesting story, and I'm so sorry, Susie, your family's going through that. Joe, as we mentioned a few moments ago, monoclonal antibody treatment can be helpful if it's in the early stages of the disease, but as we just heard from Susie, folks in nursing homes may be having some trouble accessing it. Go ahead, Joe. Go ahead and unmute yourself and go ahead. Okay, we're having more technical problems with that. We'll go back to Joe in a moment. David Bauerlein, your thoughts.
Well, she's absolutely right that when DeSantis announced this monoclonal treatments, that was something he said he was going to do, was send in these strike teams to nursing homes. Now, what the protocol is and what triggers that, I'm not sure. It sounds like the nursing home she's speaking of should be one where they're sending folks. But my suggestion would be to reach out directly to the governor's office, to state lawmakers, because that is something that the state is supposed to be equipped, able, and willing to do. So it should not be an exception. It should be something where if there's cases in a nursing home, the strike team should be sent there.
Yeah, Susie, if you're still listening, I would just keep calling and keep trying. I wish I had more information to give you. Let's see if we have Joe McLean back now. Hello. Joe, are you there?
Hello. Yes.
Go ahead, Joe.
Yes. I think the conversation needs to be more about vaccines.
Okay. Apparently your mic isn't working, Joe. We're going to have to put you on pause again for just a moment. Elizabeth on the south side. Go ahead, Elizabeth.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Has there been research into the difference between people who've had COVID and people who've gotten the vaccines and whether there's a difference in the protection from the disease?
You know, Elizabeth, from every doctor and public health expert we've talked to, if you have had COVID-19, you are provided with some protection. However, they still advise that you get vaccinated if you've had the disease already, because that provides more robust, longer lasting protection. Does that answer your question? Okay, thank you. Lots of calls. It's our Friday roundtable on the radio and live on Facebook video stream on Facebook and YouTube with Joe McLean of Channel 4 and Schindler of First Coast News, David Bauerlein of the Florida Times Union, and Letitia Barriola of Action News Jax. Jennifer in St. John's. Jennifer, hi.
Hi. I was just wanted to make a comment. I had heard that every ICU visit costs, on average, a COVID patient about $50,000. And if you're choosing not to get vaccinated, I would assume this would increase the premiums for all of us who did get vaccinated in the long term. And I was wondering if putting a premium or saying, you know, if you end up in the hospital and you have a deductible of $10,000 because you chose not to get vaccinated but go to the ICU, would that maybe help people who are hesitant get vaccinated?
Yeah, Jennifer, thanks for that. Ann Schindler, let's talk about this. The Biden White House has instituted vaccine requirements for large companies. Some companies have already been doing it. They've raised insurance rates for the unvaccinated. These are the kinds of nudges that could finally get us towards the end of this ordeal. Ann.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I think we all know, but perhaps it's worth just stating again, the cost of getting a vaccine is, you know, profoundly less than the cost of treating people either with monoclonal antibodies who've contracted the virus or people who just get the illness and end up hospitalized. There's been some recent calculations that unvaccinated people in the U.S. have just in the last 3 months cost $6 billion in medical costs in terms of, you know, taking care of them. For hospitalizations and other treatments. And that's preventable.
$6
billion of preventable costs. So whatever, you know, it's going to cost in, you know, terms of testing or vaccinations, it's a drop in the bucket compared to what it's costing the country in healthcare costs. And yeah, somebody's going to pay that. I mean, it's either going to be your grandchildren, you know, with like the taxes that they pay, or it's going to be you and your health premiums. It's not cheap.
That's right.
And, you know, I will say too, we've talked recently on our station a lot about the ECMO machines, which are considered, you know, kind of last resort, but they basically handle, you know, blood and oxygen in your body for you. It's like an external life support, essentially. And some people need them and they've been hard to come by. And one of the reasons they're hard to come by is because they require a 24-hour a day nurse to attend to you. And in this time of nursing shortages and general labor shortages, the idea that one patient is going to require a full-time, you know, probably two people a day, essentially working 12-hour shifts just to attend to them because of the machine is, it doesn't, the formula doesn't work.
Yeah. Yeah. And then Joe McLean, we have you back now from WJXT Channel 4. It's heartbreaking to almost every day see another story of someone who has died of the disease, who was unvaccinated, who did have to go in for this very expensive treatment, and very often is leaving behind children without parents. This week, we all saw, I think, the story out of San Diego, a young-ish couple, both under 40, both died and left behind five small children. It's just tragic and infuriating.
And it really is. And what people don't understand, we reached that 50,000 milestone, if you want to call it. And if you really think about that, that's in Florida, that is 50,000. Every single one of those 50,000 is leaving behind people, is leaving behind friends and family, children in many cases, grandchildren. Every single one of those 50,000 leaves an impact. I just did, I covered a story yesterday about a teacher, a special education teacher, who had worked at Nice High School in St. John's County, and now is working at the new middle school there. Her death, that the district had to activate the crisis team to help people at those two different schools, entire schools affected by this one death, and every single one of those 50,000 is leaving that kind of impact.
That's right. Folks, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, if you're just tuning in, with Joe McLean, Letitia Barriola, Ann Schindler, and David Bauerlein. We are live on the radio, and you can watch the video stream right now, too, on Facebook and YouTube, and later on demand at PBS Jax Passport. The number to join us, 549-2937. We're going to move ahead now and talk about some other news and notes from the week. Let's talk about the City Councilman, former mayor, and longtime public servant, Tommy Hazzouri. Hazzouri was laid to rest Thursday at a service in Mandarin, as his family and friends told lots of stories about his life and legacy, many with jokes and humor. Hazzouri died Saturday after developing complications from a lung transplant. He was 76. David Bauerlein, there was a bipartisan show of support at this service, which also people could watch on video, to remember Tommy Hazzouri, who played a huge role in the civic life of this city and in the state, too.
Without a doubt, it was a long, almost half-century span of service that he's been involved in politics at every level, and left a large, large impact. I think one of the most striking things about all the sort of remembrances and memorials and to him is just this idea that the personal is political. He really was a what you see is what you get type of politician. And, was known the same way by his friends and family as perhaps people who work with him in political life knew him, as somebody who was hard charging, sometimes somebody that people got angry at and then made up with and got angry at and got made up with. But he was really somebody who gave a lot of his time, attention, talents to this city for a long time in public service.
Right. Locally, Hazzouri was known for the big accomplishments were getting rid of tolls in the city, which were very unpopular, getting rid of paper mills, which were very unpopular, caused an unpleasant odor. But Letitia Barriola, he went on to serve in a number of other ways. He served in the state legislature, on the city council twice, two different times, and on the Duval County School Board.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, one of the big, his legacy is that, I mean, he worked all the way up until his death, practically, right? I mean, when he went in for surgery and announced the lung transplant, you know, we weren't sure if we were going to see him come back and continue working. And, I mean, sure enough, he did. He came back. He went back to work. And when he announced that there were complications, just several weeks later, he passed away. And so when you look at his life of service at all those, you know, city, state, and country, I think there was a reverend that said during the service, what didn't he do? And he made a point to say that, you know, he could have retired at any point a long time ago. He could have retired from this work, and he never did. You know, there was no quit in him is what people were saying. And so that's something that really touched me. You want to do something that you love so much that even into your 70s, even after a major medical complication, you're back at it. And I think that just proves how much he actually loved this work and loved this city.
Yeah. Joe McLean, Channel 4, right up until the end, Hazzouri was playing an important role when it came to the legislation to provide taxpayer dollars to Lot J. He took a strong public stance on that. He took a strong stance against the Republican National Convention being held here indoors due to the fact that it would increase the spread of COVID-19. In his final months, he was still making an impact.
And that impact, again, is having like a ripple effect. Very few people, I think, have reshaped or have changed the course of a city like he did. And you're talking to a guy who just moved to Jacksonville like a year and a half ago, but I learned pretty quickly hearing his name that this was a person who really personified public service. And like David said, he didn't really have any, with his so many years in public service, there weren't really many secrets left to him. He was very, you know, open and very direct. And that's how I think he's going to be remembered.
People told a lot of stories at the funeral, and Schindler, I'll tell one of my own now. Tommy loved to do this show, and he was never shy about asking for airtime. And so when he asked, we generally said yes. And so, and, you know, through the years, sometimes I would hear from other colleagues of Tommy Hazzouri's on the city council saying, you know, how about some equal time? Why is Tommy always on? And I just said, look, the squeaky wheel gets the grease. I'm happy to have you on anytime. All you got it. If you ask, we will put you on. So that to me is one of memory I have of him.
Yeah, that's pure Tommy. I mean, I was going to say earlier, we talk about what he's remembered for, you know, the odor and the tolls. And the reason he's remembered for that is because he never stopped talking about those things.
That's right.
You know, so that's his legacy preserved in part by him. And I really appreciated the way that our colleagues at the Times Union commemorated him, which is, you know, they really avoided this sort of like, you know, hagiography that a lot of times we apply to our, you know, leaders once they're once they've passed, you know. And they point out he could be, you know, thin skinned and he was garrulous and he was volatile. And David had a great line when he was covering the funeral. He quoted one of the speakers as saying, you know, everybody that had ever gotten, you know, had ever gotten angry with Tommy Hazzouri, you know, raised their hands. And a lot of people raised their hands. And he said, look, don't worry about it. I know he was probably also mad at all of you, you know, which is, you know, he never, you know, sugarcoated who he was. But he definitely loved to be in the center of every debate and would put himself there. And he, you know, made himself available because he enjoyed being a part of that whole machine. And he was a master of it. I mean, he really did know how to, you know, grab the spotlight when he felt like it was going to serve his cause or even when it was just going to kind of, you know, give him something to do. So he's well remembered as a complex person and also a really, you know, I think inspirational leader for a lot of people.
That's right. Let's take a few calls on the passing of Tommy Hazzouri. Alan on the South Side. Go ahead, Alan.
Hey, Melissa. Hope I'm not jumping the shark here, but and before I say what I want to say, let me ask for Donna Deegan's forgiveness if I'm too blunt. But has it struck anyone else that how coincidental it is that Tommy wasn't even cold in the ground and Shad Khan's back with hat in hand asking for a third of the $450 million that he wanted from the city to...
Well, I think that might be a bit of a reach, Alan, honestly. But we're going to talk about the Jaguars in a moment. So keep listening, Alan, and I appreciate the call. Willie on the north side. Go ahead, Willie.
Yes. Tommy came from good stock. I live on the north side, and he thought about the entire city. I was on his staff from 89, 90, and 91. I was on his staff. The good thing about it, and the reason I say he come from good stock, I knew his grandfather and his father and uncle. And they were great people. They helped the they did a lot for the African Americans on the north side. He was the first one that I know of that introduced doing something about Grand Park. It used to flood. I was with him when he took down the toll bridges, and also introduced a policy which didn't go through about the problems we're having now about the garbage collection.
Yeah, that's an ongoing problem, by the way. And Willie, thanks for sharing those memories. I appreciate that call very much. Thanks, Willie, on the north side. Jack Webb on the line, former president of the Jacksonville City Council. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Melissa, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, listen, I got a funny story. About a couple of years ago, it was, you know, Tommy used to hang out in Panera's in Mandarin on San Jose Boulevard with this gaggle of guys every morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
And this was right after we got elected. I guess the mayor had just gotten elected or whatever, Mayor Curry. And there was kind of a love fest going on between the council and the mayor at the time before other things happened, obviously. But anyway, so one morning I walked in, and Tommy's there with his boys. And one of the guys asked me, Jack, what do you think of the mayor? And I said, well, you know, I didn't think much of him until recently. And he goes, well, what happened? I said, well, I think he's a miracle worker. And he says, well, why do you say that? He turned your boy Tommy into a Republican. And Tommy started sputtering. His face got all red. So I'll go Republican. In any event, God bless Tommy Azzori. Thanks for taking my call.
Jack, thank you for that. And thanks to everyone who's gotten in touch on that. It's our Friday Media Roundtable. As we look back on the biggest stories of the week, 549-2937 to join our panel, our fabulous panel of pundits. You can also watch them right now on our live video stream on Facebook and YouTube. I want to skip ahead to a story that you are covering, Ann Schindler. The JEA grand jury. Now, JEA's former chief operating officer, Melissa Dykes, appears to have testified to this federal grand jury. This is in connection with an ongoing probe into the botched effort to privatize the utility. What can you tell us, Ann?
Well, so I actually was at federal court yesterday for a sentencing in a sex crimes case up in Nassau County with a fire rescue officer, but it was canceled, which turned out to be actually rather fortuitous because Melissa Dykes arrived there with her attorney. You know, they have been doing Thursday grand juries and we have been at some of them, but we didn't have any sense that this was a big day for her. So anyway, she is a landmark witness, really, right? We weren't even sure whether she was going to be cooperative in this investigation or even possibly a target of this investigation, because she was a close confidant of Aaron Zahn, the former head of JEA who was ousted. She was his number two. She served as interim in, you know, after he was fired and before she was fired. You know, this is a story that has so many people who kind of could be peripherally connected, you know, to this lucrative bonus plan and the failed sale of the utility. So it wasn't really ever clear, I think, and she had refused to participate in a city council committee that was investigating this. So I think there was some question, you know, at least in the popular mind about, you know, what, where is she on this? But her attorney made clear yesterday that they're cooperating with the Department of Justice, they're working with the Department of Justice. And when we asked if they were there willingly or happy to be there, he said, we're not unhappy to be here. They both had big smiles when they left court, did not seem to be, you know, downtrodden or grim. And so my, you know, my sense is that she's there because she's going to be a witness for federal prosecutors in this probe. And I would guess her presence yesterday at federal court would suggest that they might be moving towards a resolution. She really is the top person that had, that, as far as we know, had not yet been called to testify.
So David Bauerlein, this grand jury investigation had really gotten pretty quiet, and they potentially could be coming forth with indictments. Well, we don't know. Federal grand jury proceedings are secret. They could issue no indictments, David.
Well, that's absolutely a possibility, too. I mean, say, first of all, Ann Schindler really covers her waterfront on the court system.
Yes, she does.
So no surprise to see that she was the one tweeting out that news. I think that, you know, I mean, the fact that the investigation has gone on as long as it has, the fact that somebody like Melissa Dykes is being testifying and could be a star witness, depends on what she knew, what she talked about, certainly indicates that this investigation still has legs. And then we just have to wait and see. It feels like it's getting closer to a point at which they decide one way or the other, because as Ann mentioned, you know, it's hard to think of anybody at JEA who would have been closer to Aaron Zahn and the decisions that were made during the course of this attempted JEA sale than Melissa Dykes, because she was right there in the upper echelons of the JEA leadership.
Yeah. You know, Letitia Barriola, Action News Jax, this prosecution has been looking at, or the prosecutors, I should say, the federal prosecutors have been looking at the attempt to privatize the utility, which failed due to public outrage. They're particularly looking at this performance unit plan that the former CEO Aaron Zahn was trying to get through. It would have allowed the senior staff at JEA to enrich themselves to the tune of nearly $1 billion. That's the most controversial part of this whole sordid affair. But Letitia, the big question everyone has who's been following this is, will the indictments only flow to someone, say, like Aaron Zahn, the former CEO, or will the mayor or anyone close to the mayor be caught up in this? Will they face criminal prosecution due to their alignment with this effort to privatize the utility? Letitia, I think there's a fair bit of skepticism out there that anyone at City Hall will have real legal exposure. What do you think?
Yeah, and I think that the public's interest really started to peak once they started to understand the relationship between the mayor's office and Aaron Vaughn. And as you know, with TV viewers, right, we have our graphics to try to help explain this story because it is so in-depth and it involves a lot of different players. But once we started talking about Lenny Curry, we started talking about Aaron Vaughn and how he got the job and his not a lot of experience at all doing this type of work. You know, once we started digging into the relationship with City Hall, I think the public did sort of perk up a bit, that and the bonus plan, right? But I think that it will be, that has been really quiet, mostly because of the grand jury, the talk about the relationship and what that may mean. But I do know the public is especially interested to know if the mayor's office will, you know, show up at some point along this timeline. But so far it's been quiet. But I can tell you that between the bonus plan and between the mayor's name being floated around and all of this, people want a conclusion to this. So, you know, April, I believe this is when this all started. We've got a lot of other things happening in our city with the pandemic, and so it's gotten pretty quiet. So it'll be interesting what actually comes out of this grand jury.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, a minute ago or a few minutes ago, we got a call about the Jaguars. Let's talk about the Jaguars for a little bit. Shad Khan, as the caller pointed out, put forth his incentive plan. The city council is moving ahead with vetting this. A $114 million plan to build a Four Seasons hotel and other structures on the north bank of the St. John's River. Your tax dollars, folks, are going to help do this. At the same time, Jags coach Urban Meyer became the subject of speculation this week. He denies that he is interested in a vacant coaching job at USC. Of course, Meyer's been under a lot of criticism over the past month due to the underwhelming performance of the Jaguars so far. Joe McLean, Channel 4, let's begin with you on this. It's highly likely Shad Khan's proposal to the city is going to be approved. Let's begin there.
Right. And I think so much of what is going to come out of this is going to be reliant on a lot of public perception. I mean, because particularly, obviously, that area is so central. And, you know, citizens of Jacksonville basically have to look at it. And I think there's a sour taste in a lot of people's mouths when they think of someone getting money to build something and enrich themselves. That's the perception. And I think that's something that is going to have to be kind of overcome for anything like this to move forward. I mean, it's going to have the public, the citizens of Jacksonville behind this solidly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, David Bauerlein, the taxpayers revolted against the Lot J plan, which is what the Jaguars originally came out with. This is a bit of a scaled down plan, but still a lot of money.
It's still a lot of money. I mean, the Lot J plan to do this entertainment center with hotels and apartments, that was a much larger amount of taxpayer incentives going into it, and a lot more money up front than this particular deal is. I mean, one thing on the Four Seasons Hotel, we keep referring to it that way, but I suspect that one question the council members are going to have is, what assurance is it that it's going to be a Four Seasons Hotel as opposed to some other type of, quote, luxury hotel? There would be probably some questions about the financial incentives and the scope of it, but I do think, based on what I've heard so far, that it's far more likely to pass than not. And it doesn't seem to have had the same sort of heartburn going into it that the Lot J proposal had, which was rejected on this weird 12-7 vote in favor of it. That didn't get a supermajority, so it failed.
That's right. It's probably going to pass. Let's just expect that. Let's hope for some wins, Jaguars. Okay, panel, we're almost ready to let you go, but first, time for a very quick lightning round. And I'll start. Mental health grants for Jacksonville area nonprofits total nearly $600,000. That's on our website at wjct.org. 11 nonprofits are getting the money from the Partnership for Mental Health, meant to increase access to mental health services in our area, very badly needed. Ann Schindler, what's on your radar this week?
Really on the lighter side, Melissa, one of our reporters this week did a story on a bride whose bridesmaids were dropping out due to illness and financial reasons and a variety of other things. And so she took to Facebook to search for substitute bridesmaids.
Oh, no.
Yeah, so we're going to be following that. She's got a woman driving up from Tampa who said she's in, she loves to dance at weddings, and she's all about it. So she's going to be the substitute bridesmaid.
Rent a bridesmaid. Letitia Variola.
What's on my mind this morning? I talked about it all during the newscast, and my heart just breaks for this family. Hit and run that happened this past Saturday morning killed a high school senior at Riverside High School, Michael Walton Prince. He was on his way to take the SAT.
Oh,
he never made it home.
Sorry to see that.
Someone ran him over.
Not to cut you off, we're just getting tight on time. Joe McClain.
Last night, the Duval County School District surpassed, with regards to COVID-19 cases, last school year's total last night with that update. So that just is a reminder of the impact of this. Although Dr. Mobeen Rethor has pointed out that the mask mandate in the district
is helping.
Working.
Yeah. David Bauerlein.
Melissa, the American Cornhole League is holding its pro championship today at Daly's Place. So
nice.
There is a cornhole league. It is a pro sport. And if you miss that, you can see it tomorrow at 1:30 p.m. on CBS. Jacksonville in the news.
Oh, fun. That's. We'll end on a lighthearted note. We can use it. Thank you, David, Ann, Letitia, and Joe. And guys, thanks so much for being with us. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa, to you all.
Take care.
Thank you.
And in a moment, what's health got to do with it? Our brand new show debuts. We'll speak with host Dr. Joseph Servin next.
When you give to WJCT News 89.9, or better yet, become a monthly donor, you're investing in a service that is a bit different than the other news sources. First of all, WJCT News 89.9 is a nonprofit organization. We're here to serve our community, not to profit from it. Second, our roots are local. Yes, reporting comes from around the world, but it's the stories from right here on the First Coast our team is focused on. So take a few moments now and support your public radio station. Call 353-9528.
California's governor gets back to governing. Gavin Newsom's recall fight ends with a win for him and with a warning about what the country stands to lose.
Democracy is not a football. You don't throw it around.
Also, did General Milley break the chain of command, and what prompted the White House to respond to Nicki Minaj? The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Welcome back. Well, we here at WJCT Public Media are so pleased to announce a brand new talk show. What's Health Got to Do With It is a weekly radio show focusing on basic common sense solutions to healthcare problems that we all face. And man, it couldn't be more timely. Here with me in studio, I'm so excited to welcome our new host, Dr. Joseph Servin. He's a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic. Dr. Servin, good to talk to you.
Oh, Melissa, always a pleasure to talk to you as well.
It's so exciting that this show is debuting tomorrow at 4 p.m. right here on 89.9 and replaying on Sunday nights. So it's so hard to navigate the medical system, the bureaucracy. I've dealt with it. In fact, I talk about it on your show this weekend. This is a topic we all care about.
Healthcare and the system of healthcare is so complicated. And as I was listening to your weekly roundup, it hit me how health permeates all of this. And this past couple of years with COVID pandemic has only magnified it. So we're here to try to help. We're here to try to connect, give you expert advice, give other people a voice that they can kind of relate to know that you're not alone, that other people are going down this path with you, and to see how we can give you answers to navigate health and healthcare.
That's right. This is an easy way to connect with you, an expert, on what's health got to do with it. They can connect with you and the experts you're going to have on this show, get their healthcare questions answered.
We want this to be a show for all of our listeners and all the audience. And so we have a way to connect with us via Twitter or the Facebook page. We have a phone number, 904-358-6362. We're collecting phone calls, emails with your questions. Our next show coming up is going to be about false health information. And we'd love to hear your comments or your questions. We're also going to be covering almost any other possible topic that one can consider in health. But we're here for you, and we want to be able to incorporate all those questions. So the show really belongs to everyone out there listening.
Now, as I mentioned, you are a practicing neurologist at Mayo Clinic here in Jacksonville. You're also a medical journalist and a professor. So you come to this with very impressive credentials.
I appreciate that. I've been doing the journalism bit for a while now. Started at NBC Latino, and then have kind of gone on to public education on medicine for many years. I also teach on the healthcare system for Arizona State University online, and as well as my practice in Mayo. So I really want to hope that I can share all I've gleaned over many years in the career with everyone out there as to how I would treat anyone that sees me directly in the office.
You know, my daughter and I took part in your first show, which is airing Saturday at 4 o'clock. And I think that the overarching theme that you're trying to get across to people is the healthcare system shouldn't be this difficult. And why does it have to be? You're kind of here to sort of help people navigate it.
If there's ever a moment that needed navigation, this is it. And what you just said is absolutely correct. It was great talking to you and your daughter, Natalie, about health issues as you leave home for the first time as an adult. And we want to kind of get people that practical advice so that they know this is how it's done, or they can hear how others have done it so that they have that sense. But my goodness, insurance, co-pays, how to get an appointment, how to deal with medical records, what's mine, what's not yours, what are the answers? We're here to try to, yeah, to shed light on all of this.
You'll be the Sherpa for all of us, won't you? Because we need one.
I think that that is probably the thing that is most needed in healthcare today, is that Sherpa. I love that analogy, to kind of guide folks through whatever issue that you're dealing with.
That's right. And so there are many ways for people to connect with you, Dr. Servin, that they can listen live to the show. What's Health Got to Do With It debuts tomorrow at 4 o'clock here on 89.9. It'll replay on Sundays at 9 p.m. People can listen to the podcast, but you want people to engage. So let's explain how they can do that for every episode.
Absolutely. So we are always looking for your questions, your comments, as we put up different show topics, or we want to get show topics from you. So the way to do that, to reach out to us, is there's an email, which is health@wjct.org. There is a phone number. You want to leave us a message, or you want to kind of give us your story. That's 904-358-6362. You can check us out at Twitter at Jay Servin, or you can check out the WJCT Facebook page where we have our item for the show, and leave any questions, comments, future ideas or circumstances you've dealt with. And that would be huge in terms of trying to really make it for you, the listener out there.
This couldn't be more timely. With the COVID crisis, we are seeing unprecedented challenges to our healthcare system. We're pleased here at WJCT Public Media to provide this public service so that you can connect with Dr. Servin, get your healthcare questions and frustrations answered, or at least vent about them a little bit, which we all need to do. So as Dr. Joe said, email him now. Let us know your stories when it comes to healthcare. Email him at health@wjct.org. You can call and leave a message that will air on the show. Call 358-6362. Leave your voicemail so that he can listen to it and play it on the air. And listen tomorrow to the debut of What's Health Got to Do With It, hosted by neurologist Dr. Joseph Servin at Mayo Clinic. Tune in tomorrow at 4 o'clock. Catch the replay on Sundays at 9 p.m. and always look for the podcast. And it's so great to have you join our WJCT family, Dr. Servin. I know it's going to be such a vital part of what we do here.
I really appreciate it, Melissa. Thanks again.
Thank you. And thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks to all of our guests and callers, along with senior producer Heather Schatz, director Josh Torres, and associate producer Catherine Hobbs. Our editorial director is Jessica Palumbo. Keep those emails coming. Send them to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And make sure to catch the Florida Roundup today at noon, our live statewide call-in program rounding up the biggest stories across the state of Florida. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back here with our local show at 9 a.m. Monday. Be safe out there, everyone, and have a great weekend.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.